I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Set in 1989 Romania, Oana Aristide's new novel is titled Astronaut. That's astronaut with an exclamation point at the end. The book follows two characters as they navigate life under a communist regime. Constantine is a police detective who begins investigating a series of mysterious murders that the government pins on a bear, and Leah is a young girl trying to make her way in a world that's literally losing its color. I recently spoke with Oana Aristide about life under such a communist regime and how her characters defy the expectations set for them. So I'm looking at the U.S. cover of your book, and it features a young girl and a grizzly bear facing off. They appear to be roaring or screaming at each other. And then there's the title Astronaut, which is punctuated with an exclamation point. You know, after reading the book, all of this makes sense. But can you set up the novel for our listeners? Can you give us a description of Astronaut?
Sure. So we're in Romania in 1989, what turns out to be the last year of the Ceausescu dictatorship. It's a world of rationing blackouts, informants, secret police, oppressive grayness. Our main characters are a little girl, Leah, who rebels against the lack of color in her life, and Constantine, a policeman who's hunting a killer. The authorities have decided to pretend he's a bear.
So talk to me about the title, Astronaut.
Well, as you said, at first glance, it doesn't really make sense. There's no connection to the cover or to the setting. And it starts with Leah wanting to draw an astronaut at school, but her teacher doesn't allow it because the astronaut is the capitalist space traveler, and she has to call her drawing cosmonaut, who's the Soviet space traveler. And this is why the word is a little act of defiance for her, and that's why we have the exclamation mark in the title.
So I went into this book blind, and I'm not too familiar with Romania's history or politics in the 80s. And so I knew nothing about Nicolae Ceausescu, but I didn't feel lost as I was reading. Did you have a reader like me in mind as you wrote it? Or do you think, you know, knowledge of this time frame and the politics would be beneficial to a reader?
I think the only thing that's required is sort of general knowledge about that there were these two rival blocs, the capitalist West and the communist East, and that people in the East were not free, were oppressed. I think that's the only required prior knowledge from a reader. And I wrote it, I wanted to write a novel that touches on universal themes rather than a documentary about Romania in 1989.
You mentioned the two primary characters, Leah and Constantine. And when we meet Leah, she's being walked home by a shopkeeper. She's 7 years old, maybe eight, and she's quite precocious. We know a lot about her based on how adults react to her, her parents, her teacher, her neighbor. What should we know about this little girl and her behavior?
Like any little girl, she's innocent, she's curious, she's energetic. She isn't part of the regime, or she hasn't become the kind of model citizen that her parents or her teachers have become. So she approaches the rules of that world innocently, and she reacts to the absurdity of that world and rebels against it without knowing that she's performing a political act, but simply in the innocence of her childhood, she breaks some rules that don't make sense to her.
You grew up in this time and place, right?
Yes, the first 10 years of my life.
Was it difficult as a child to be surrounded by fearful adults?
You were only partly aware of it as a child. I knew, for instance, that I'm not supposed to talk to anyone outside the family, not at school, not with neighbors. My grandmother was constantly asking me if anyone had stopped me in the street to talk to me. They were very, very nervous about kids telling stuff they'd heard at home, basically informing on their family. And because they couldn't control what children say, and they couldn't also, you know, they can't adequately explain to a child that, well, we live in a dictatorship. They were trying to pretend that the world we live in is more normal than it was, that this is how it is. You know, there are queues and there are shortages and there are blackouts and you're hungry and you're cold and you have to watch Ceausescu praising programs on TV all the time. And this is all normal and we're happy about it. And as a kid, it doesn't feel right. You sense that they're making it up, they're pretending.
You mentioned the other main character is Constantine. We are seeing his perspective through part of the book. And as you mentioned, he's a police detective investigating a murder, which, you know, is a series of murders. And you've explained that the people have been told that this main suspect is a bear. But we also learn about his family through his eyes. We learn about his suffering through some inner dialogue. What is his family situation?
He's married and he has one young son, and he's very anxious about how his son will grow up, if he will turn out to be one of the, you know, utterly compromised people who are slaves to the regime and basically soulless, let's say. And he's trying to teach his son to give him a moral compass, but without endangering him. And this is why he tells him these fables that he invents. He tries to invent a vocabulary that allows him to teach his son about morality without risking that the son somehow gets into trouble.
Yeah, I felt like fairy tales was a kind of a theme prevalent throughout the book, not just with Constantine and his son, but even with some of the other characters. But another theme, and you mentioned this earlier, another theme is color. I mean, it seems like color was fading or difficult to come by or available to only, you know, only to faithful party leaders. What's happening with color in the novel?
This was based on the color strand and Leah's passion for color and her observation that there's less and less of it. It was based on I saw footage that, from Bucharest, filmed at some point, I think, in 89. Where you see a street and cars and apartment buildings, and you're convinced that everything is black and white, and then suddenly a yellow car drives into the frame, and you realize you've been watching color footage all along, but everything is just so gray that you thought it was black and white, and that gave me the idea of a child character who rebels against this lack of color, and she tries to see, she's like a hoarder of color. She wants to collect colorful objects. She wants to draw. She likes to see the town prepared for ceremonies because then they bring out brass instruments and flags. So it's, again, it's not a political gesture, but in that context, it becomes political.
This was a very serious novel. I mean, I could feel the tension when the adults would become frustrated with Leah, but the reader also would be frustrated with Leah at points. But I did laugh out loud a couple of times. You know, one was the bear joke about wearing bells. And then the other one was the scene with the chicken queue. How much fun was it to write that scene?
That sort of society where there are a lot of absurd rules that people, they're forced to obey them, but they don't actually believe in them. And then they try to work around that system. It's naturally absurd and ridiculous. So there are many situations in that world that you can use for comic effect. Whenever behaviors aren't natural, that invites ridicule. And Leah exploits some of that. Yeah, I enjoyed writing that, yes. It started as a short story, actually, that chapter.
Oh, interesting. There was a scene where Leah and her mother had watched a movie, and it was about pamphlets being distributed to end World War II, if I remember that right.
Yes, it was communist youths who were distributing anti-fascist pamphlets.
And Leah got the idea to distribute her own pamphlets, didn't she?
Yes, she thought, well, that's a tried and tested method of solving political issues. So she did some of her own. And that's actually based on something I did when I was a child, but I was much less, it was even less political than Leah's gesture, because I wrote, "Down with Ceausescu, I want more cartoons." There were no cartoons on TV. There was just these endless patriotic programs, and I just wanted more cartoons.
Did you get in trouble as a child a lot?
Not in this way. Not in this way. I wasn't like this all the time. My parents and my grandma are very grateful that I didn't get into trouble with the, you know, with the state apparatus. But yeah, occasionally children might do things that are risky in that way.
You know, we've already established that you grew up in this time and place, but you also, you know, you have quite the resume: a chief economist, advisor to Romania's prime minister, writer, hotelier, just to name a few. Do you think your lived experiences impact your writing?
That's a very difficult question. I haven't generally written about my experiences other than, well, this some episodes from my childhood in this novel. But I guess just with doing different things, you learn about people, you learn about, I also lived in many different countries. You learn about different cultures, you learn how people are different and how they're still the same. It's, I suppose, hopefully over time, it's just accumulated wisdom.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Astronaut?
There is obviously a political message, but I hope I've honored the contract between writer and reader, that they care about the characters, they want to spend time with them, and that they feel that they traveled to a world they might not have otherwise visited. But I hope they take hope away from it, that they're left with this idea that in any system, however oppressive, there's always hope, and there are many, many different ways of resisting.
Well, the book is Astronaut. Juana Aristide, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very, very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Joining us now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is David Malman, publisher rep for W.W. Norton & Company. Welcome to Marginalia, Dave.
Thank you for having me.
You are the person who told me about Juana Aristide's book, Astronaut, and we just had her on the show today, and I wanted to ask you some questions about it. Like, what first drew you to the novel?
I almost never say this, but it may have been the cover. It's a really astonishing cover that just grabs you. But also, you know, the idea of reading a story set in, what, late 1980s, communist, you know, Eastern Europe. It was just, you know, a time and place I've never really spent time with in literature or elsewise. So,
you know, you didn't steer me wrong with that one. So what else do you want to talk about today? What other book recommendations do you have for us?
I have some of my favorites of the year so far, and I've kind of kept out some of the more obvious ones that have already gotten all kinds of attention, and picked some of the, I guess, sleepers that also happen to be among, I think, the best books of the year. First one I want to talk about is called Night Night Fawn by Jordi Rosenberg. This is a story about a woman named Barbara Rosenberg. I believe she's in her 80s, and she is suffering greatly from a terminal illness. She is on drugs to help her through, and really the only person there to help her is her son, who she still thinks of as her daughter. He's a trans man named Jordi. And she, after all these years, has obviously never come to terms with her son transitioning to a man, still thinks of him as her daughter. And she's a very bitter, bitter woman. And this entire story is told as if she, Barbara, the old woman, is writing it, but it's all being told in her head. And it's about all of the opportunities she had in life that she lost, about all of the things she thought her kids would do that they should have done that they didn't do. And it's just a rollicking read. The prose in here is electric, and you get the feeling that the author, Jordi Rosenberg, this is like a novel length getting something off his chest. And it's both delightful and hilarious and kind of cringy and everything all at once. It's really an amazing piece of prose. I just couldn't stop reading it. So,
I was surprised to hear you, after you first described it, to say it was rollicking and fun, because it doesn't set up that way, does it?
No, it doesn't. But you just kind of let yourself go to his writing. It's exuberant. And yes, it often sort of will sort of turn you the wrong way, kind of make you feel a little uneasy, but I think it's meant to do that. But ultimately, it is one of the best novels I think I've read so far this year.
High praise indeed. Okay, what else do you have?
I just recently read this novel. It's out in July by the author Roam Baird. She had written a previous book called The Divorcees, which I had never read, but I had always heard good things about. So I thought I would read this new one. It's called Tenderness. And it's the story, it takes place in the 1970s. It's the story of a young woman who is getting married on a small private island off the coast of Virginia, where her family owns land. They're a very well-to-do family. You start to learn very early on in the book, everybody is talking about her and whether she's going to be able to go through with this marriage, whether she's going to be able to stay married, because she is not long out of Synanon, which I didn't know much about, but that was one of the big cults in the 70s. Started out as sort of a self-help thing, but became ultimately a cult where everybody was shaving their heads, people were encouraged never to leave, and she ultimately does leave, finds this man, tries to marry him, and now we're watching as the wedding is about to take place. And it's narrated by herself and her brother and one of her closest friends. And you find out not far into the book that some people have been seen on the island who don't appear to be with the wedding party. And the worry is that these people are with Synanon and have come to take her away. It is not a thriller or a mystery, but it has sort of that underlying story that feels like it could be. But I just really loved the characters. I loved how it was written through the three different perspectives. It was a very surprising book in the best way.
Oh, very nice. Any other recommendations for us?
Yeah. Well, you and I just talked last night, and I mentioned this book, Questions 27 and 28 by Karen Tay Yamashita. This is, I think, her second novel. She had a book several years ago, maybe even a decade ago, called I, Hotel, which was nominated for awards and got all kinds of attention. This new book, Questions 27 and 28, is about the Japanese internment camps in the 40s during World War II. And it focuses on the Japanese people who were interred. And the questions of the title, Questions 27 and 28, were questions that they had to answer on a long form when they were interred. And question 27 was whether they were willing to pledge allegiance to the United States. And question 28 was whether they were willing to essentially renounce allegiance to the Japanese emperor. And the way people answered these questions really split up these camps, it split up families. People really got upset with each other that not everybody answered yes, yes, or no, no, or yes, no, or what have you. But the internment camps are really just the center of the story, and the entire novel revolves around it. We go from the turn of the 20th century all the way up to almost present day, reading about both the ancestors and the future families of these interned Japanese. And it's just incredible. And it goes all over the place. It's not just in the camps. I mean, you're in Wichita, I'm in Milwaukee. There are scenes in both of those cities. It's historical fiction like I've never quite read it before. So,
have you read I, Hotel?
I have not, but now I want to go back and read it. And knowing me, I probably have a copy of it somewhere. So one book that was very funny is Villa Coco by Andrew Sean Greer. Andrew Sean Greer, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize a few books ago for his novel Less, an unusual book to win the Pulitzer Prize because it was a comic novel. And he is one of the funniest writers working in America today. And this is about a young gay archivist fresh out of college who takes a job on an estate in rural Italy working for an octogenarian woman who needs her art collection archived. And he gets there and essentially ends up doing everything but what he's supposed to do for his work. Everything this woman needs, which has nothing to do with his degree. But he ends up really falling for this odd woman who bosses him around. And of course, there's a love affair with a married man, and there's, all kinds of weird scenarios between characters. But he is just such a funny writer. Sometimes it's just the turn of phrase. It's not even the situation. It's just the way he says it. I laughed out loud many times. I just thought this was kind of a priceless book.
You know, we were able to visit with Andrew Shangrier about this book. And in the galley that I had, he had written a letter to the reader saying that his goal was to write a charm novel, one that you would hold to your chest after you finished reading it. Do you think he was able to accomplish that charm novel?
I do. It had that quality. And of course, I love reading. There's lots of books I love, but it's unusual to find yourself smiling through the entire reading experience. And this was one of those books where I just was enjoying it so much that I was just smiling as I was reading. So,
very nice. Okay. Any others for us?
I wanted to do a couple from smaller presses. The first is from the publisher Seven Stories. It's called Field Notes from an Extinction by Owen Walls. It takes place in 1847. The main character, his name is Ignatius Green. He's dispatched to a remote island off the northernmost tip of Ireland, and he is sent there to study the last living colony of great auks. And it's a very lonely job, but he is obsessed with it. He has deliveries every week of, you know, food and things like that because he's all alone. There's a village, you know, not too far away, but he's just by himself. And one day the delivery comes and the food crates have been broken into. Some of the stuff has been either damaged or spoiled. And then after the ship that leaves the delivery leaves, he discovers that in one of the crates is a child who appears to be essentially feral. And he has no contact with anybody for at least another week or two. And he ends up taking in this child. And it's the story of this man and this child on this remote island in northern Ireland. And it's just an amazing story about what family is, how family is made. It's oddly funny at times, although it's not a comic novel at all, but there are really some surprisingly funny moments. I'm not a big historical fiction reader, and now this is the second historical fiction I'm talking about, but this really moved me. This is one I definitely want to go back and reread.
How often do you go back and reread books?
Not very often. But I frequently want to.
But this is one you might actually do. Okay, that sounds fascinating. And sorry about the audible gasp. What else do you have for us?
So another one from a smaller publisher from New York Review Books. They tend to re-release sort of lost classics, as they like to say, books that came out earlier, usually in the 20th century, that have been out of print for a long time that they think deserve to find an audience again. And this is by somebody with a pretty well-known name, Robert Coover. The novel is called The Universal Baseball Association Incorporated, J. Henry Waugh Proprietor. And the book was written in 1968, and it's about a guy who has come up with a system to develop an entire league of baseball teams and players that he goes through the motions of these contests between these teams by rolling dice for each transaction of the baseball game. You know, there's a pitch, he rolls the dice and determines whether it's a hit or an out or what have you. And this is interesting because this is before fantasy baseball or rotisserie baseball or any of those kinds of things. You know, he saw this coming. But this guy becomes obsessed with this to the point where this baseball league is really the only thing he loves in life. He works, we see him at work, and he just is completely disconnected because all he's thinking about is getting back to see what happens in the next game against this team and that team, and will this pitcher prevail? But there is a certain situation where if he rolls all sixes, for instance, something extremely dramatic could happen. And that ends up happening towards the beginning of the book. And what happens is that the pitcher, who's in the middle of pitching a perfect game, gets hit in the head with a line drive and killed.
Oh, my word.
This not only throws off the course of his Universal Baseball Association, it really throws off the course of his life. It's a fascinating, fascinating book. One of the reviewers who had written about it back in the day said it's one of the best baseball novels ever written. I think that's true, which is a weird thing to say since none of it is about any real baseball players. But it's funny and weird and kind of bawdy at times. And I had never read Robert Coover. I had always heard of him. And I kind of thought he wasn't for me. And I was really surprised how much I loved this book.
So you are a sales rep and you do not rep for New York Review Books, right?
I do not.
How did you discover it?
So I have a subscription that was given to me by my sister-in-law that I get a New York Review Books book once a month, you know, one of their new releases. And sometimes I read them right away. Sometimes I think, oh, I'll read that eventually, and I never get around to it. But this is one that I read right away, and I was really glad I did.
Do you have anything else for us?
Yeah, just a couple more. You've heard me talk about this one. This is probably my favorite novel of the year and may end up being that at the end. It's called Drayton and Mackenzie by Alexander Sterrett. He is a British novelist. It is a story of two young men at Oxford, one of whom is exactly what you picture an Oxford guy being. You know, he comes from money. He sort of gets there through nepotism, but he's also extremely smart and extremely motivated and graduates at the top of his class and is clearly going to do great things. The other one is a guy who comes from a similar background, but is not as motivated and is much sort of harder to keep on track. And he does not do well, ends up at the bottom of his class, kind of a laughingstock. A couple of years after graduation, these guys come in contact with each other again and surprisingly hit it off. And they end up forming a company together. What they're going to try to do is harness electricity from the power of tidal ocean currents in the North Atlantic. And it turns out it's a brilliant idea, but also a very difficult thing to do. And, you know, I could say more about what they're doing and whether it works, but really it's the story of the characters and not just them, the girlfriends that come in and out of their lives, their parents. I fell in love with every character that came through this book. I didn't want it to end, even though it's like, I think like a 500 page book. It's one of the best novels I've read in a very long time. And if you told me I have a novel for you about a couple of tech bros who do really well in business, I'd be like, why would I want to read that book? But it's brilliant. It's incredible. And the reviews have been amazing. And I think it's going to be on a lot of best of lists at the end of the year. So again, the title is Drayton and Mackenzie, which is the last names of the two main characters, by Alexander Sterrett.
All right. You said you had one more for us?
Yes. So this is actually one that we distribute, the publisher. I'm with W.W. Norton, and we distribute some smaller publishers. This is from New Directions. It is called Behind the Gate and Other Stories by Amparo Davila. And I know you know her because we actually read the title story in a reading group together. Mm-hmm. This is the second book of hers to be published in English. Amparo Davila died a couple of years ago in her 90s. She was extremely well known in her home country of Mexico. She was like Shirley Jackson or Patricia Highsmith level. Very, very popular. And really was virtually unknown here in the United States until New Directions published a book called The Houseguest in 2018. So now this is her second book of short stories. It's not quite horror. It's kind of horror adjacent. The stories feel like they take place in reality until you get a few pages in and you realize it's just a step or two outside of reality. It's very eerie and uncanny. Actually, NPR, when the first book came out, called her Mexico's answer to Shirley Jackson, which gives you a good idea of the kind of writer she is. And I just love her stories. Some of them are maybe 8 or 10 pages, and it's amazing how much she crams into such a small space. I loved every story in it. Some of them are creepy. Some of them are just weird, but they're all pretty brilliant.
Well, you once again have given us so many books to consider. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'd love to do it again sometime.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.